Okay, first of all, questions? Okay, hearing none. Okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go through and talk about the project where I'm actually... going to look at the, see if I can make this a bit better. We're going to go through in order. And look at the various parts that we'd want to address in the project, more or less in order. Let's see if we can get this display working correctly. Says it's finding it here. So we're going to talk about the overall goal, the specific aims that we want to look at. Talk about what's the scientific burden of proof. Okay, now this goes along with what's the specific aims, but it's useful to think about this separately, to say what is it that we have to do in this trial. Talk about the sampling scheme and what impact that has on what we do. How we'd go about summarizing the effects, what sort of analysis we want to look at. And then we get to the real crux of the matter, which is anticipating problems. And just a very good idea to realize that there always will be problems. And so you need to anticipate them. You need to plan for them. And missing data is, in fact, that major problem that we'd like to talk about, is how would we go about handling the missing data in order to answer our question. And a lot of that, this what is the estimand, is really getting at saying even defining what is missing data is the problem. Talk about what the primary and secondary analyses are, and then talk about what descriptive statistics we do. So sort of go into reverse, where you decide what it is that you're going to present in your paper around what's leading you into the analysis. So we start sort of at the end to say, what is the question that we're trying to answer? How are we going to answer that question? And then what supporting documentation will we have at the very beginning? So going back to the overall goal and specific aims, what is our overall goal in the beta carotene data set? Let's go even higher than that. What's the overall goal? Why do we care? Cancer prevention. And this will drive some of our decisions in our analysis, is that we're looking at cancer prevention. So our specific aims We have two in this set. Okay, now this is, I'm dividing up these questions a little bit differently, but there are two specific aims directed towards the overall goal. Finding a treatment for cancer prevention, that's our overall goal. Before we find a treatment, we need to assess that it is efficacious and safe. Safe and efficacious is probably the better way to think of it, so I'll go with that. There's all levels of safety that you would consider. There is the level of safety to perform a clinical trial. Those are usually our phase one clinical trials. Those are where we do the first in human and, you know, very few subjects and stuff. We're beyond that. We feel comfortable giving the beta carotene to people. So we're at the level of looking at, and I'm, even though I said that safety is always the first thing to do, I'm going to put down the efficacy. The efficacy. What is the efficacy question that we're addressing with this? Some clinical trials, we never address efficacy. This we are barely. And what is that? What are we looking at? That's right. Possible to get it. And I'm going to go ahead and throw this word just in case you've never heard it before. This is to introduce the word. But we are sort of looking at pharmacokinetics. Okay, we're just wanting to understand how supplementation leads to blood levels. True pharmacokinetics, they get into how is it absorbed, how is it excreted, you know, what dosing they're doing. We don't go to all that level, but we are just trying to find out what these plasma levels go to. So our pharmacokinetics of beta carotene are summarized as plasma levels. And plasma levels win. Well, so getting into the sampling scheme a little bit here, plasma levels at 9 months, that's the best we can do, right? Now, given everything else we had in here, you could have said, oh, but wait a second, we've got it at 1 month, we've got it at 3 months, we've got it 3 months after they stopped therapy, but those aren't all directed towards the overall goal. The overall goal is we want to understand how we would give this treatment and prevention and have the patient potentially benefit, right? So plasma levels at 9 months, which is really just the longest available. And this is where thinking about the overall goal becomes important, because the fact that our overall goal is prevention is what tells me I'm really interested in the longest available time. If it were treatment, these patients had cancer and I was trying to treat cancer, I'd be interested in how rapidly it gets to the therapeutic dose and stays at that therapeutic dose. But because it's prevention, the long-term effects are of more importance than the short-term effects. If it takes 9 months to get up to the level that prevents cancer, that's okay, we have that part. Most patients. So we would with that. Okay. Now, we'll wait for that. And then our other specific aim, that is safety, a little bit data-driven in truth, but we're pretending that it wasn't. And that's the pharmacokinetics of vitamin E. So this one's a little bit harder. A little bit harder. When are we interested in for this? And again, you could say that we're interested in the long-term safety. You could say that we're interested in safety problems that occur at any time. What are you trying to answer? Are we trying to answer what will be happening to those individuals who can keep taking this? Or are we trying to answer how many people will be able to tolerate this? Those are two slightly different questions. And by the way, if instead of just looking at vitamin E levels, we were looking at incidence of heart attacks, there's no question. We were looking at incidence of heart attacks. It's how many people are having this problem. But when it's just something that's just a little bit suggestive that maybe people won't tolerate it forever, that drives us more into the long-term safety. But this is a value judgment. This is a value judgment. You can, you know, you would work with your collaborators to decide. Carly?
Why are we assuming, how do we know that vitamin E is important for safety?
We don't. Although, what's the definition of a vitamin? Pardon?
Essential for life.
It's essential for life, just like oxygen, but oxygen's not a vitamin. So what's the distinction? Oxygen is. Uh-huh. Water is.
Cannot make it yourself.
Cannot make it yourself. That is a requirement for the to be called a vitamin. The original word was vital amine, but then they started throwing the things that were amines. It's that we need only small amounts of it. Usually this concept of food, otherwise we call it food, right? Food. So a very distinction, but you know, vitamin E was sort of iffy for a while as to, you know, was this really vital or was it not? And we also get into games about, you know, some of them, can we store them for a long time or do we need them every single day and things like that. But the presumption is, but you're absolutely right, but the presumption is that if we're interfering with vitamins, a distinctly American thing to worry about. Those of you who, you know, come from other countries that make fun of Americans with their preoccupation with vitamins, I'm on your side. But the presumption is that if we're damaging what vitamin levels might be, then it becomes automatically something that you ask yourself, is this a safety problem? But it's not guaranteed that it's a safety problem. I will say that was our focus. And it was our focus, and again, this was a little bit data-driven, but this idea that because they started noticing this in the data set, they said, should we investigate this further because of the possibility that low vitamin E. Vitamins go through fads. When I was in college, it was vitamin C. You know, that was the big thing. Then, you know, beta carotene stuff. But vitamin E was a fad for a little while, that everything was, you know, vitamin E. Now it's, of course, vitamin D is the vitamin that you need to have. So again, we're looking at plasma levels. And again, it's acceptable. You know, there comes every time in a data analysis, we have to make a decision. And the person who cares the most, the most important person to any analysis is, of course, the journal editor. So, you know, they aren't sitting by you. Right? Well, okay. Your other collaborators and things like that. They aren't sitting by you and realize that every time I make a decision about using mean or a median, I'm making a scientific decision. If I make the decision of, do I fit the slope over time or do I just look at the 9-month level? I'm making a decision about what I want to be able to detect and where to go wrong. But at this time, then the way I phrased the question to you, it was at 9 months. Again, the longest available. And Carly's question enters into my decision of saying, is this a really big deal? My answer is not necessarily, in which case, transient effects, I don't think I'm doing lasting damage on. But the heart attack I would have been afraid of, lasting damage, I would have shifted to heart attack in ever. So that's our overall goal, specific aims. So what's our scientific burden of proof? Now, this is a hard thing, and we haven't really talked about this too much. But what do I mean by this? It's what's going to be done with the results of this? How, you know, it's really coming down to how much of a pilot study is this? How much license do we have to consider multiple primaries to maybe look at a little bit broader exploratory analyses versus this is a confirmatory analysis. You know, this is something that the last thing we want to do is mess up our inference versus this is a pilot study. We still want to control our type 1 error rates, but it's not totally driven what we want to do. So what is our science?
burden or a fairly light burden?
I'm going to claim, you know, this is a pilot study. So in this pilot study, we would like somewhat reliable estimates of the plasma levels of beta carotene. My presumption is the beta carotene levels will be affected. I just don't know by how much. You know, that's the concept here. That's the scientific. But the idea is it's more to detect whether vitamin E levels affected. So again, this is just this idea of what's the, you know, back to the journal editor analogy. What's the minimal publishable quantity? I don't think any of you, if a paper came across your desk and said, here, I've conclusively proven that if you eat more beta carotene, more of it gets into your blood. You know, you would say the same thing no matter what I gave you. Even something that was supposedly non-absorbable, you'd say, I still bet there's a little bit that gets in your blood. You know? So that concept, it's not good enough. What we'd really like to do is understand what the plasma levels go to. But on the vitamin E, it's not as clear that they should be affected. And it certainly, in retrospect, 20 years later, I can say, this doesn't really look like these results were later confirmed. So that means that just demonstrating that there is an association is what we want to look at. The sampling scheme, what are the key words that we want to keep in mind? Randomized clinical trial. Others? I didn't like that it. Oh well, we'll live with it. What else is important? Longitudinal, very important. What about the longitudinal aspect? So we have monthly measurements, monthly measurements, what else? Three-month placebo run-in. We're going to come back to this one. I'll just say why. Nine-month supplementation. Three-month follow-up, which doesn't enter into our thing. Okay, what else? Useful to know. Go back up to the randomized clinical trial. Right, healthy volunteers. What else? Five arms. What else? Probably not the biggest deal in the world given what our goals are, but it's still nice to note.
Blind.
Pardon?
Double blind.
Double blind. We don't always think that they cheat on their blood levels, but it's always nice to know that that we do have that amount of rigor, perhaps. And by the way, the blind wasn't absolute in this clinical trial since beta carotene turned you orange at high doses. So, okay, so these are key words that it's nice to know about the sampling scheme. The key point being, when it comes to writing your abstract, a goal should be, gee, how many of these things can I get into one sentence in the abstract, right? You know, this is the very, very important information, and can you be creative? And note that in your abstract, you'd really like to also tell me how many healthy volunteers. You'd like to give me the sample size. You know, so, and it doesn't take much, you know, usually two keystrokes. 46 healthy volunteers. 5 dozen. Then the question is, what do you do about the 5 arms? Do you actually say 0, 15, 30, 45, 60, or 5 doses ranging up to 60? Or say placebo and 4 doses ranging up to 60. You want to give people some concept of what it is, so 15 to 60, something like that. The idea of how you get into that abstract, you know, after a 3-month placebo run-in, patients were to have at least have supplementation for 9 months. And the follow-up could be mentioned or not, but you're wanting to get the feeling. Now, understanding this why for the placebo run-in can affect it. You don't know, I didn't tell you, but if you think about why there was a placebo run-in, that might drive a little bit of your analysis, so you should think about it. Why do you think we would do a placebo run-in? Compliance? Baseline? Washout. If these patients had been on beta carotene supplementation beforehand, you might do a run-in to get them all off of that and back to a baseline. Okay, so that's a possibility. Where does this come in? If it's compliance, great. It's all baseline values. Let's just average all the baseline values. If it's just to get the baseline, the more accurate, well, obviously, average all those baseline values. If it's washout was why they did that, you might not want to average all the values. You might want to just use the value at the end. These are just things that you would think about, that you would ask about. It occurred to me as, just this year, 20 years later, I did always average these, and now I can't really remember, other than at the time, the people that I was working with were always concerned about compliance. And so, but why such a bizarre number is 46, and why do I have some data that I didn't give you that I only have during the run-in period? This is the thing. So, in this trial, truly, compliance was more of the issue, that they wanted to find people who would put up with having the blood drawn on a monthly basis and things like that. But just realize that the reasons why people do things could drive you to handle this data differently. Yes?
Just a logistical question. What is the first patient month that they started supplementation? Is it end visit 3 is the baseline, or is end visit 4?
In visit 3, they have just finished their last month on run-in. On that day, after their blood draw, they start taking the baseline. So that is the time of randomization. So up to month 3, so we actually have the time 0, 1, 2, 3 that are all while. But 0 is not on the... 0 is not on the placebo run-in. 0 is prior to starting to take anything. So again, if this were a washout period, they might still have been taking it. You know. So, and again, these are just things that you think about, and so you possibly do different things. So run-in, we want to say washout versus precise baseline versus compliance. Okay, that's our sampling scheme. Now, we're going to have to get a little bit circular here because there's issues that enter into our decisions. But if all things were perfect, how would you summarize the effects? What would have been your ideal here? Okay, how we would summarize it, the mean. Why not? Okay? So, mean. What would have been your other choices? Sorry, I'll put this. We could have gone with the mean. We could have gone with the geometric mean. What else? Why not? What else? We could, except that would be, and you know, there are reasons why you might do this if you're saying, I want to see where they are tending to stay in a tight range, whether there is a dose that they do that. And so that could be an issue about keeping them in there. Usually we would get that on a per patient basis, and we'd look at peak levels and trough levels and that sort of thing. So I don't want to discount it, but but that is a measure of spread more than it's a measure of location. Okay. What else could we do as a measure of location? If only I knew what threshold I cared about it, I could do a probability above a threshold. I don't happen to know that, so that makes it easier. Left to my own devices, again, not knowing anything, mean is what I'd choose. If I dealt with this data a lot, it is a laboratory measure, and it is something that we're intervening on, and there may be that heteroscedasticity or multiplicative effects that I'm worried about. But if I don't really know that that's going to be the problem in the range that we're at, I'll use the mean, first of all. You know, and that is, in true life, what I did too. I didn't go through the geometric mean with this data set. But it would have been acceptable. There was nothing wrong with doing that. But means are understood by more people. And so if that will do it, that's what I'll go with. Okay, what else? So that was just the summary measure we'd look at. What other things do we have to think about? Pardon?
Spread.
The spread? Okay. Yes. And I'm going to, again, cheat here and just say what I'm going to go ahead and just say what I tend to do. If I am worried about the spread of the data, if the peaks and troughs are a real problem and things like that, usually what I care more about is I have some threshold. But sometimes, I mean, in the manufacturing process, you maybe don't care what you control of that. All that you care is that it is controlled, right? You know, how are computer chips manufactured? Oh, we make a whole bunch and we test them to see which ones are within the range. And then we call those chips that were in one range. These are the 2 gigahertz chips, whereas the 1 gigahertz chips are the ones that didn't pass the 2 gigahertz things. You know, so that there's that concept of understanding that operating range is there. But most often in biomedicine, if we're worried about variability, it's because we have some level that we don't want to exceed. But that's not absolute. I mean, you know, people who have, well, I was going to try to use something like orthostatic hypotension, but yeah, usually there's this threshold. Below a certain level, you fall over. So, but the aspect here is, back to the sampling scheme, we have these measurements, but we have these measurements over time. How are we going to handle the time? And what are our choices on handling the time?
You can ignore it.
Ignore it how?
Just choose a single time point.
Okay, so we could have a fixed time, e.g. 9 months. And that's what I typed on earlier slides, was saying that's what we wanted. But what else could we have done? Pardon? You know, you could do that. We could say multiple time points, and then we'd have to say, how are we going to treat the multiple time points? Sometimes we treat those as co-primaries, you know, which is we want to make certain that it was a good mean at time 1 and at time 2 and at time 3 end at time 4, or we could say, did it ever hit that level? So I'll say any versus all. So we would look at all of the endpoints, but then it's the question of what did we demand? What did we demand? Okay, what else could we have done? Okay, and how would you have summarized it with linear regression? The slope. So we could look at how it changed over time. What else? Okay. So that would be of particular interest. Again, if we had the idea that there might be some toxicity, but we weren't as fixed on what the threshold was, and since everything is going according to plan, we don't have to worry about the sample size problem. We'd have the exact same measurements on everyone. What else? What else could we do if we were ignoring it? Pardon? Average them, sure. Okay. Another thing that we could do. Slope is contrasting. So it's really a slope is really taking differences. Averages are finding a constant level is there. What else could we do? And this one is not something that would be used real often, but we could look at the cumulative exposure. You know, the months times your level. So this cumulative type thing, not used very often, but it is used when we're measuring drugs. You know, we're saying, what is your cumulative exposure to the drugs? We take your dose times the time that you had it. Pack years is such a measurement. But I just write it down here. Product of time by level. These are things we could do. Okay. Which of these seem most reasonable? Seem most reasonable for our question? The summary measure? I think the suggestion of the mean is about best. And time? Probably the last measurement. Probably fixed at 9 months. But there's arguments to be made for others. If you choose another one, you just have to make certain you wrote your paper justifying why that was. I mean, you'd have to explain why that was your choice. And you don't do that based on, well, it was the one that I got the result. You have made that decision before you got there. Carly?
What about for the second question?
Yeah, so we said before that, I almost said that we need to answer this for both. So I say fixed at 9 months for beta carotene, definitely.
Well, no, the second question is about the effect of.
Okay, that is the secondary aim, and I'm going to take that under the secondary. I've got another slide where I'm going to look at the analyses. But you are right. For the second question, we want to do this. But looking at this. But I probably would do this for vitamin E as well. But a better argument could be made perhaps for, let's just go with the minimum vitamin E. Because I'm not sure when any effect would show up, and I want to give my best chance at finding it. You know, so if there's a lot of variability, it also comes down to, would I care about a transient effect or not? You know, what are you trying to diagnose? Are you trying to diagnose how the patients will fare if they take this for a year, or are you trying to diagnose a drug that has an effect on vitamin E? And if you're trying to diagnose a drug that has an effect on vitamin E, whether it's transient or permanent, you're interested. But if you're just trying to think about long-term effects, then the long-term effects is probably what matters. So again, you just think about it. I probably would have gone with vitamin E. It's simple. I have the mean on the vitamin E as well. It's simple. Okay. Okay. One additional issue, and you could argue that this is, well, I'm gonna leave it at this. Yeah, I'm gonna leave it at this. Okay. So what problems do we anticipate? Okay, missing data. Why? Pardon? Are they different people in which? Right. Okay. And but why would people be missing data? Okay. Non-compliance. And I always think about this. I put this in one of the bad people. They're just bad. They don't do what they're told. Okay. And that's what I mean by non-compliance. There's other reasons that you might be non-compliant besides they're bad people, but we tend to use different words for those. What might those be? Adverse effects. Now, you use, somebody said, adverse reactions. So there is actually a distinction in our world between those two things. Adverse events are things that you wish didn't happen. Adverse reactions imply you know they happened because of the drug. In a clinical trial, some people drop off due to adverse reactions. They think, really, they're just adverse effects. They were on the placebo group. You know, but that doesn't stop them from saying, you're doing this to me, I'm going to quit. So we are very careful to use adverse effects, and novices in the clinical trial world, which unfortunately includes many of the investigators that collaborate on the clinical trials I work on, I'll say, oh, this person's having an adverse effect. Oh, no, the drug couldn't possibly cause this. I go, they were hit by a meteor. They wished it didn't happen. It's still an adverse effect. An adverse event, not effect. An adverse event. So, you know, that's the concept of these words. They may be dropping off because of that, and it doesn't matter in some regard whether it was from the drug or not at the level of them dropping off. We're interested in whether it was from the drug or not. What else? Comorbidities. I'll put this in here. It's, you know, do you call pregnancy a comorbidity or not? Well, it's another medical condition that certainly would have you come off of the treatment. You know, so things like this that can happen that are not thought to be related to the drug at all, but you know, they're struck by lightning, they can no longer get into treatment. So that. What else? Efficacy. And in what way? So it could be cure versus lack of efficacy. And I've seen cases where either one of these can happen. You know, people are feeling pretty good. They stop taking the drug on their own. They continue to feel good. You never see them again. Or they aren't getting the effect they want. They want to go on to other treatments. So these are, you know, these are the major things that you know, I categorize this as. And then this becomes very important as you're looking at this missing data to say, what do you want to do about it? And so we heard that part of that was saying, well, we try to characterize the sorts of patients because, of course, if we find that a major amount of people who are missing data are men, well, we know it's just the fat people aspect that they're far less likely to follow directions. They're also far less likely to go to a doctor, you know, things like that. So, but the idea is that if you found that perhaps the the lighter weight people were having more missing data. You've worried more about maybe toxicities due to overdosing or something, because we don't always get it exactly right. You'd look at the idea that it was the people who started off with some renal compromise, or you know, you make up all of these things to try to assess what is going on. Okay?
Are comorbidities a subset of adverse events?
Not necessarily. I mean, and that's why I put pregnancy. That's a good example of something. Well, and I guess you could argue what it's doing, but you'll go there. But it, sometimes...
In the eyes of the trial.
Yes, in the eyes of the trial, it's what else is going on. You can worry about it, but sometimes we use the word comorbidities because, in the methotrexate data, the patients who got cancer... Now, we could say, I'm worried that I was worried that they might have gotten cancer from the methotrexate. That is a possibility. But more importantly, because they had to go on chemotherapy, it was contraindicated to be going on chemotherapy at the same time taking another cytotoxic drug. So, you just took them off the trial. If you developed a contraindication to the treatment, whether or not it was really causing you problems. So, pregnancy contraindication to the treatment. You don't put pregnant women in a clinical trial. And about 20 years ago, you therefore didn't put women in a clinical trial because they might get pregnant. The NIH said, no more of this. And now the FDA has laws that says no more of this as well, that they have to force companies to use. So, yeah, you try to anticipate, and then you have to decide what you're going to do about that. Okay? So how do we want to handle this missing... Oh, I should say there is one other problem that this probably wouldn't occur to you, but I'll just tell you, now you know, and so now you can never again say it doesn't occur to you, but non-adherence to schedule of measurements. Wouldn't it be nice if when I told you to come in every month, you came in every month, rather than 3 weeks sometimes, 5 weeks another time, you know, and... that you don't have the true schedule of measurement for each subject. So this will sometimes make a big deal, as, for instance, if we were trying to analyze every single month, you're going to have to consider which is more important to you. They said this was visit 5, so I'm going to treat it like the 5th month. Or visit 5 actually occurred 3.2 months into the trial, and so therefore I'm going to treat it like 3.2 months. And if you look at this data, and if you look at the dates, and I do strongly urge you to actually compute the days on treatment rather than trust the measurement. On the, I can give this to you, but on the documentation for the audiology data set, at the very bottom of it, it tells you how to convert the date format into number of days, and then you just do subtraction. And so just, that's a descriptive statistic that you'd like to say. This is the actual number of days that we have. It's an outcome. It's not a baseline variable. It's just an outcome. You know, but this is the average amount of data. Just putting that for description is worthwhile. So, again, as we decide to go with the 9-month measurement, the final measurement, you're just going to take anybody who you have measurements that are close enough to 9 months, perhaps. But you'd want to maybe select out those. Okay? Handling missing data. So the very first question is, what is the estimand? Back to these reasons for having missing data. The bad people thing I wish I didn't have. They are a fact of life. Adverse events, comorbidities, lack of efficacy if we're in such a trial. I cannot with good conscience say that I even wish the people had kept taking if those were truly due to the drug. Not the comorbidities, but if they truly had a contraindication to the drug, if they were truly having an adverse reaction, not just an adverse event, or if they were truly not getting efficacy, I don't want them to keep taking the drug. And it's irrelevant to me what would happen to those. I mean, you know, if a frog had wings, how far would it fly? Who cares? You know, and a lot of the time characterize the missing data problem as the same as mechanical engineers sitting around discussing what weight of oil should be used in perpetual motion machines. It's just irrelevant. You know, they don't exist. So this is the what is our estimate? What do we want to estimate? How do we want to handle these very good reasons for people dropping off therapy? So what do you think? I characterize there being three questions that I might entertain, but I haven't been doing this as many years as others, so maybe over the years I'll start thinking of new divisions. But the ones I have are, what is the effect in people who will take the drug? That's one possibility. Another is, what is the effect in people who could take the drug? And the last is, what happens to people who start taking drug? My simple characterization, lots of nuances here, but my simple characterization of saying, what's important to me? What's important to me? If somebody starts taking the drug and doesn't keep taking it, do I care what their plasma levels are had they kept taking it for a year? But again, if I was looking at heart attacks, do I care whether they had a heart attack while they were taking the drug? That I care about. You know, so again, this becomes very science dependent. But what is my true focus here? My true focus is finding a drug that might prevent cancer in at least some of the population. The people who cannot take the drug, it cannot prevent cancer in. But should that kill the drug because 90% of the people can't take it? Do I tell the other 10% that would benefit that, sorry, we won't allow it? Or do I try to identify the 10% that can take it and tell you what would happen in those? But safety comes into there. Is it safe to try people on the drug and then have it not work? So there's lots of times that I'll shift between the first question and the second question in what I wish I could estimate. In cancer, we almost always go what happens to people who start taking the drug, because there's a time window. If you start taking the drug and then it turns out you can't take it, you are now at a disadvantage because your cancer has progressed and I should have been giving you something else. We want to count that against the drug. It's not safe to try people on it because they're missing their window of opportunity. But I'm treating, you know, your headaches that you get every single night. And don't worry if, you know, I don't get the headache tonight. There will be another one tomorrow night that I can try treating. You know, so giving you that chance to say, oh, put up with the headache a couple nights while you see if it works. And then if it doesn't work, drop it. But among those people who can keep taking it, what's it doing there? That's a different question. And this is a big issue to, well, Bob Temple in particular at the FDA just keeps on saying the symptomatic treatment, the missing data in those symptomatic people, we want very much just to find out to what happens to the people who can take it. Is it doing something for some amount of the population? And can we assess that safely? So what do you think here? What are we mostly interested in? I'm on the side of question one. Question two, I usually don't care about too much more. This is just the idea of what if I could make the bad people take the drug. And there's always the argument that if I told the people that it really worked, then they'd really take the drug. But since I'm telling them I don't know if it works and that they tend to be non-compliant, then they won't bother. But I always hold up smokers as my example here. We tell smokers that we're pretty dang sure it's bad for you, and they keep smoking anyway. So I'm not certain that we will get better compliance in the general population than we get in a clinical trial. So I'd probably side with question one. But if we side with question one, what's our problem? We want to maintain comparability of randomized groups. This is a hard thing to do. This is a very hard thing to do because the people who drop out on the highest dose are not necessarily the same people who drop out on placebo. So how do I make them comparable? Sometimes we do a special clinical trial design where we put everybody on the drug, and then among those people who are still taking it a year later, we remove the drug brand. So we're sure they can tolerate it. We're sure that they are willing to keep taking it. And then we establish efficacy. So we're answering that first question, but we have no idea about the safety because we have to do a different analysis to find that. In this data set, this is going to be a real problem, right? You're going to have to address, but I don't know a real good way that's perfect, but you're going to have to try to address the comparability of those subjects who randomized. So what you'd like to do is say, okay, if I take the high dose group in this particular case, those are the people who can keep taking. I have no problem with that. The trouble is, among those who are in the placebo group, which one of those that did drop out wouldn't have dropped out if they'd been in the high dose? Probably nobody. There isn't really an efficacy thing here. But if there had been an efficacy thing, the people who dropped out might have had efficacy, might have stayed. But in terms of adverse events, the people who dropped out of the high-dose group because of adverse events wouldn't necessarily drop out of the placebo group. They're still hanging around. So you need to give some thought to do your results stand up if you randomly took some of the people from the placebo group and removed them. And if that stands up under that, then you're sort of done, and you can maybe just eyeball it and say, I'm not too worried about this. You know, you mentioned the way we analyzed this data, we had some people drop out. There may be non-comparable groups. But if everybody in the placebo group's measurements are way more similar to each other than the ones in the high dose group, does it really matter? So that's just a sort of bottom line analysis. It's an eyeball test. It's nothing there. Other people will try to guess what the measurements would have been and do things like that, but that's a very hard thing to do. Okay? So primary analyses.
I have a question.
Sure.
You mentioned non-adherence to the schedule of measurements. So is the right approach to that to you're evaluating at, you know, 1, 3, 5, 7,
yeah,
9 months or whatever, you get the measurements that are closest to those times.
Usually. That's what I'll do. Or I choose a window and I average all the measurements that are in that window. Say the 3 month measurement is between 2.5 and 3.5 months. And I'll just take all of those measurements. Or the one that's closest is reasonable. I have in some analyses actually interpolated, but that's with very frequent measurements, and there are some issues with doing that. But that, you know, that's the idea. You just try to do something reasonable. Okay? So what should be our primary analysis?
Sorry, at a given time point, what if a patient has multiple reoccurrence measurements?
So at a given time period, they point they don't, but on a given visit number, they might.
Yeah,
so don't trust the visit number.
Okay.
Trust the days. And this carries on over to truly don't trust ages. Trust birth dates. You know, but and that not a big deal in this particular study, but very often you find errors in the age versus birthdays, and I always trust birthdays. Primary analysis, what are our choices? So we've decided on means. We've decided we're interested in the effect at 9 months. Well, pretty straightforward.
Two tests comparing the difference of the means
means between the baseline and each of the different dose groups.
Okay, so t-test on t-test between doses on change in plasma level. Okay. And I'm going to add in one additional thing for each dose. Okay, so between dose, and let me do it this way. Dose placebo. This is one thing that you could do. We could get fancier. We could get fancier next quarter, where you try to analyze all the doses at once and look for a dose response. I personally have been burned too many times in a case where I'm trying to quantify the dose effect. When I'm trying to quantify that effect, I've been burned too many times by fitting the straight line type thing to it. But on vitamin E, fitting the straight line was super fun. I'm not trying to quantify the effect, I'm trying to detect an effect. So, but a very simple approach for this class would be just to do the comparison and do it for each dose. Okay.
So yeah. We're not necessarily interested here, like placebo versus 15, 15 versus 30, placebo versus 60.
Probably not. I mean, there, as exploratory analyses, you could look to say, can we see an effect between 60 and 15, for instance? That's where I would start, you know, to say that. But starting off with the difference between placebo to describe the effect, and the question is where does it start becoming more descriptive? So we're just going to look at those numbers. Because generally, we lose power. I mean, you know, and lack of statistical significance does not prove they're the same. So I wouldn't get too caught up on that personally. Next quarter, if we were analyzing the same data set, I might be asking you to do more than this, but not too much more, to tell you the truth. What else could we have done? Yes.
Do we have to worry about multiple comparisons?
Well, yes, you do a little bit, but how badly, it's not absolutely clear to me. If we were trying to just prove that this had an effect, so again, down in the vitamin E, I worry a little bit more about the multiple comparisons because there we're trying to demonstrate an effect. We're pretty sure there's going to be an effect here. The question is, we're quantifying it a little bit more. We're trying to get that inference on the differences, and so that scientific burden of proof is not, the type 1 error problem isn't as huge, but truthfully, I would have done something. You don't have the methods now to do this omnibus test, but truthfully, that wouldn't make sense. Okay. What else could we have done? Right? By randomization, we could ignore the basin if we wanted to. What I've been discussing in discussion section is we could also do a linear regression on dose and baseline. And this is the one that's the best to do. It's adequate, certainly, to do the t-test on the change. In this highly correlated data, that's better than doing the throwing away the baseline. If you didn't have highly correlated data, you'd be better off throwing away the baseline than taking the difference. But just to do a linear regression in which you say regress, you say your final measurement, you say the dose, whatever you're measuring, that's this binary variable that is measuring the dose you're caring about and placebo. One for the dose you care about, zero otherwise, and then you put in the baseline measurement. That is the best way to handle clinical trial data.
I don't understand, wouldn't that be, shouldn't that be a straight line? I mean, shouldn't there be no correlation between dose and baseline?
Well, dose is what we care about. We're just trying to adjust for baseline. So I should say linear regression of final or change. I don't care which of those two things you do, but that's your Y variable.
Oh, okay.
And then you have two X variables. But it's only you only care about the inference on them. Okay? And then on the secondary measurements, where we now are considering time, this is where you could consider looking at minimum or maximum, if that made sense, as we did with the DLCO. Probably not as much of an issue here. Truly, what I would just do is similar analyses at other times. You could examine that. Why do you do this? Is either to look at, say, how early did it show up, or are there transient effects? And I'll just note, you could consider whether you just do this purely descriptively and just give a graph. Give a graph of what the means do.
What in regression are you suggesting doing that instead of either of the t-tests?
Yeah, because the t-test would be linear regression on just the dose. So all you're doing is you're doing an adjustment.
How do you get p-values for linear regression?
They give it to you. They give you, we'll be talking about this, but you get the estimate and give you confidence interval. A p-value rather than something.
So in discussion section, I was showing how the t-test matched up to the linear regression on a binary outcome, how it was exactly the same if you did the equal variance t-test and you did the linear regression without the robust. They're the exact same numbers when you do it on a binary predictor. Now throwing in another variable is just adjusted for baseline. Those are the words we use. Okay? And you'll bear with me again. Actually, we can just do this in reverse order. Have we all seen Memento? So, right? Every movie should have a beginning, a middle, and an end, just not necessarily in that order. It's a Tarantino quote. Descriptive statistics. Now that you know how you're going to analyze it, whatever you chose to do, what do you need to present in the way of your descriptive statistics? And that's real easy. In a clinical trial, table one. In table one in a clinical trial, what do you always present? Yeah. So means of baseline variables. Baseline variables include demographics, anything that you measured at before they started taking it, means of baseline variables by dose group. Y'all have more of a problem than do the audiology people because you have five dose groups. You know, you need to provide all of the news that fits. So how do you do that? Because we also want it would be nice to know ranges for materials and methods. But confounding, which is what you're interested in comparability of the treatment groups, that is something that happens when the means are not comparable across groups. I don't care about the ranges. I don't care about the medians. I don't care about the interquartile range. I don't care about anything but the means. Slight disclaimer that I'll put on that, but this is generally true. But when I tell you that I used 46 healthy volunteers, wouldn't you like to know how old they were? Would you like to know the range? So an approach for this, where you need five columns for the doses and you can't fit everything in, an approach is give the means and standard deviations in table one, and in your text, give the ranges for the variables that you care about. The age, maybe BMI, maybe, you know, percent bad or something like that. But let the means of those things just fit in the table, and then you can give the other range in your materials and methods and be able to get across that. And then, of course, the other table of sampling scheme, which is basically length of follow-up. You'd like to see that by dose group. And then table of estimates of effect. And a preset. You're given 5 pages, no more. I stopped reading at 5 pages.
Including the tables?
Pardon? Not including tables. But I get to judge how big the tables are in terms of how many pages, whatever. And you can put the tables in line or at the end, I don't care, whichever. And I don't really quit reading because I can't count. But my goal would be to stop reading that. This, you know, we aren't looking for something in each step here, but I think you can report the important things succinctly. I pay a lot of attention to the abstracts. You will get my feedback on the abstracts from your draft. But I probably won't read any of the rest of them. So if you look through the past papers from 2009, 2007, those are posted there, you will see that there are way more comments on the abstract than there are on anything else. Okay, other questions? I don't care if you do. I mean, you can do it, but you don't have to. You didn't even have it.
Do we need to look for computations?
If you wanted to do some exploratory analyses, that would what it would be. Of course, you would pretend that that was always on your mind rather than you go fishing through 19 variables. Again, with the effect modification, when we do that in clinical trials, we have pre-specified the groups that we will look at. And in a properly done thing, that if you later found it in something, you'd have to say, in a completely post hoc analysis, and everybody, you know, immediately shuts off their ears at that point because they've been burned by post hoc subgroup analysis. So be able to justify why you thought that that might be of interest.
Can we throw away the measures on the follow up analysis?
I never asked any question about those, and so yeah. Do that. If you wanted to speculate on effects that, you know, the missing data might have on things, but probably that's not a big deal. So there's no question. Other questions?
Can we during the period, during the draft period, can we specify that we're only interested in 3 months, or are we interested in all the mid 8 month period and just see where the drug
is? So the natural questions that I would ask, said I'm interested in the long term primarily. And then the two things that I would look at is, if you did not show an effect, but I imagine that somebody else did, or somebody else said, oh, surely there has to be an effect, you might say, was there a transient effect that I missed? If you did show an effect, it's only natural to say, how early did it show up? Okay, so those are a little bit more descriptive. They aren't something big inferential things that I really care about, but I would like to at least describe that that's how it sort of did behave. So that's the way I would. But you could imagine that just a graph answered that question well enough, or perhaps it didn't. Perhaps you really wanted to test that aspect. But look at how it's behaving and realize again, you know, if we were going to let this trial determine that we were going to go ahead and launch into a 10-year study of how this affects, you sure do wish that plasma levels were at steady state. So that's another reason to look at the time. If you're seeing that the levels are continuing to rise up to the end of the study, you might be a little bit. So, again, I would tend to look at the last measurement, but there is an interest in seeing what else is happening. Okay. I'm going to switch to audiology.